You are listening to The Vitals, a twice-monthly podcast for all things oncology nursing. For even more content, check out oncologynursingnews.com or find Oncology Nursing News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Hi, everyone. This is Lindsay Fisher, editor at Oncology Nursing News. In this episode of The Vitals, Holly Chitwood walks through a patient case with a 70-year-old male with metastatic colorectal cancer. His providers used circulating tumor DNA testing to monitor his MRD levels throughout active treatment. This approach, although not currently addressed in National Comprehensive Cancer Center guidelines, allows patients and providers to have an idea of how the treatment is working earlier than imaging can usually demonstrate. Chitwood is an assistant professor in the College of Nursing at the University of Kentucky, as well as a practicing APRN. To read the full case study, please check out our show notes below.
My name is Holly Chitwood. I am an assistant professor in the College of Nursing at the University of Kentucky. I'm also a practicing oncology APRN in medical oncology, and I deal primarily with gastrointestinal, hepatobiliary, and sarcoma tumors in my clinic. So I am a board certified adult gerontology acute care nurse practitioner and a family primary care nurse practitioner.
Really glad to have you today. So in your article, which was published in the Clinical Journal of Oncology Nursing, you presented a case study with a patient with metastatic disease. Can you talk about this study? How did the patient present to clinic?
The patient is a 70-year-old male who presented with the common symptoms of colorectal cancer, iron deficiency anemia, unsure where the blood loss was coming from, denied blood and stool, had some lower abdominal discomfort, and had some pain with defecation, some frequent urgency to have a bowel movement, that typical kind of presentation for a colorectal cancer. This is the perfect case study using ctDNA in a metastatic setting. So this patient had a mass, of course, in the colon, but also had pulmonary metastasis and adrenal metastasis, which is common with colorectal cancer, did not have liver metastasis, which was a good thing. But as we started treatment, you know, you could see that level stay stable or decline. And then as treatment resistance developed over time, you could see that level slowly rise. And then we would switch therapy and it would come down. And it kind of fluctuated with what was happening with the patient clinically and was a little bit ahead of what we were seeing on imaging.
What treatment regimen or treatment regimens was this patient receiving and why?
We considered starting the standard of care therapy, which would have been FOLFOX for this patient. The patient was 70 years old, so we were going to try FOLFOX alone to start, even though they're metastatic, just to see how they tolerated it. And then in the decision-making, when we shared this with the patient and we talked about, we assessed for peripheral neuropathy at baseline, I would have gave this patient an overall ECOG status, which is a performance status of 1, maybe moving into 2, but definitely a solid, you know, 1 on most days. Had a little bit of hypertension, but very well managed by the primary care doctor. But then the patient shared that they had some evidence of neuropathy, unsure from where that was coming from at baseline. And because they were 70 years old, we decided to moved toward FOLFIRI instead of FOLFOX. So FOLFIRI, of course, is 5-FU, leucovorin, irinotecan, and we tried to go that route with the patient and limit oxaliplatin, which, you know, can be really hard as far as the toxicity profile for our colorectal patients.
And while this was happening, could you talk about some of the numbers that you were seeing and how you explained that to the patient?
So for this patient, when we started, and I will share that this case study is a little bit altered to protect the patient's identity in numbers and also in dates of measurements, just to try to help protect the patient identity. So if you look at that, the patient was well over between 600 and 700 at baseline on the minimal residual disease, the amount of cancer floating around at diagnosis. And you can see a dramatic drop within the first few months of treatment. And you can see that that dropped down to, let's see, down to 0.16 mean tumor molecules per milliliter. So you can see that dramatic drop in figure two down in the first few months of treatment. And then you can kind of see that that number is rising again when you start to look at it. And the interesting thing is that the scans had showed stable disease. There were no treatment changes made because, again, that ctDNA rose then just a few months later up to 71. So again, we went from 0.16 up to 75 mean tumor molecules per milliliter. So that was a pretty big jump. And of course, we did that with imaging, but the imaging was stable. The patient was doing okay on treatment. So we didn't make any treatment changes. And that's a really important thing. So when you're starting to measure the minimal residual disease, you've got to decide, one, how much do you trust that number? Two, do you have actually enough evidence to make drastic changes in treatment that may come with more toxicities for your patient? That's a big thing with this because there are no current clinical practice guidelines that incorporate this into practice and exactly how to interpret the numbers. But if you move on with this patient, just another 3 months later, you can see that the ctDNA now continued to rise. And there was pulmonary progression of disease noted. So now we have imaging that correlates with the number rising, the numbers rising again. So in this case, and in a lot of my patients, you will see ctDNA is about anywhere from 2 to 3 months predating what you will see on imaging.
Yeah.
So when you see a number rising, and especially if you have it consecutively rising, and you don't have it on imaging, you can expect that it's going to happen. And that's what we see in practice. So that's the take home here. And you can kind of follow this patient and see where the number rose and it rose a little bit more. And then it went down when we switched treatment and back and forth.
Okay, so the ctDNA monitoring showed higher levels of ctDNA in the blood before you could see it on imaging. But you did not change the patient's treatment until that was evident on the imaging. How did you talk to the patient about it? Were they worried about these numbers that they were seeing?
A lot of times, patients need just a very, very clean explanation. This is a new technology that we have, and it's basically looking at the what's in your blood to see how much circulating tumor DNA is floating around. And you talk about that, and you explain that when the cells lyse from either apoptosis, necrosis, or other things, they break open, they spill the contents into the bloodstream, and we can actually look at a sample of your blood and measure how many, you know, tumor molecules are floating around. You have to be very judicious in explaining the results, especially if you have a positive result, and the patient should be included in the decision making. A lot of times it gets a little sticky. Patients will come in and be like, "What's my numbers?" Or, "I saw my numbers in my chart. Are you worried? Are you worried?" The take home is this should not be used alone to determine treatment. You should have it as a piece of the picture, a total piece of the puzzle to put in there with imaging and how the patient's doing overall before you change treatment options. And that's something that can get kind of sticky when you're explaining to patients what the next step is.
So right now, ctDNA monitoring is a tool in the tool belt that providers are using to get a complete picture of what's going on with the patient. Moving forward, do you think it might play a more prominent role?
I think that the more research that comes out, and ctDNA is being used in multiple research trials. I think the last time that I looked on clinicaltrials.gov, there were over maybe, I don't know, like 150 maybe trials that had some component of ctDNA used in the trial for different types of cancer. So as research develops, I do think this will be in clinical practice guidelines in the future. I don't know when, but we really have to narrow down the science. And you think about this, most largely what I have discussed in the article and on this podcast has been tumor-informed ctDNA analysis, but there's also tumor-uninformed ctDNA analysis that basically searches for a large collection of variants associated with a certain type of cancer, and you don't have a tumor specimen match. So there's a lot of concerns with this. How accurate is it going to be? But the data from the research studies that I've read and I've also discussed in this are showing promising results. But also, you have to wonder, are they detecting maybe variants that are associated with maybe a lung cancer that you didn't know the patient had? And then what do you do with that result? And that's really going to be challenging ethically. You know, are you going to jump on a cancer because you have a ctDNA that's positive and you don't know what exactly it's coming from? The companies that offer the platform for testing do not publish the variants that they're looking at too. So that's another thing. As we narrow it down and there's more research, it's going to eventually be considered as an adjunct to all the puzzle pieces to make your treatment decisions and decide which way to go.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And then, how's access to ctDNA monitoring? Are all patients covered by insurance for this?
So this is always the sticky conversation. It is Medicare and Medicaid approved, and they will bill, you know, Medicare. Some states have mandated biomarker testing coverage, and it remains to be seen how this is going to play into that technically biomarker category. So mandated health insurance legislation in several states that, you know, indicate that they have to cover. But then you've got to think about our patients and financial toxicity. How much do they have to cover? And it is very expensive. I don't have a direct quote. That's kind of very hard to track down. And there's several different platforms for the tumor matched analysis. There is one company that pretty much has the market, but the tumor uninformed, there are several companies that are doing this in clinical trials and commercially, and they will bill insurance, and they do have patient assistance programs, which is great. Some of them will even cover the cost of the test. So when you talk to patients about this, you have to know what the rules are in your state, how it's going to get covered, if the patient's going to get billed, even if they have insurance, can they afford that bill? Do we have patient assistance to help, and to what level? And that you've got to find, you really need to find that out and be, you know, in touch with your local industry representatives who offer the testing. And then, you know, it is indicated in colorectal cancer. It's being used in breast cancer. It's being used in lung cancer. And it's also being used to monitor treatment response to immunotherapy. So looking at that, it has a few indications, but you're sometimes going to have to fight with insurance as a provider if you really think this is going to add to your treatment regimen and provide the best care for your patient.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Vitals. Be sure to never miss a beat with oncology nursing news.